This episode is going to be very different from normal. Very, very important note. This recording is paired with tons of video references, images, links within a Substack newsletter called Matt's Recap, which I will link in the description of this show. Definitely, I would recommend to listen to this audio as it's truly intended to be paired with a written narrative to make a much cooler story. This episode, it's intended to be used as a custom resume to explain my overall entrepreneurial journey for a specific employer, VaynerX. VaynerX is Gary Vee's owned conglomerate communications company, and they have a really particular insight into who's up next in the music scene. Gary Vee and the head of music at VaynerX, Mike Boyd, run a playlist called Monday to Monday, where they feature artists who they think will be up next. To emphasize how good they are at seeing what's next in culture, actually put me on to Nipsey Hussle years ago, before myself or even a lot of my hip-hop friends knew who he was. Now that's insight. Shout out to my brother, man, and one of my best friends since the first grade, Solo Cello, whose Spotify streams have exploded from under a few tens of thousands to over 10 million in this year's Spotify Wrapped. Gary Vee and Mike Boyd discovered Solo Cello and featured him on the Monday to Monday playlist only a few months ago. And since then, in the midst of me trying to figure out what to do next with my career and my life, Solo went out of his way to reach out to me and tell me, man, you gotta talk to Mike Boyd. Let me make the introduction, write up some stuff about yourself. We'll make it happen. I think something amazing could happen. I'm really determined to not work for anybody right now. I don't really want to have any boss, but I'm willing to make an exception for VaynerX Music. I think it would be fantastic to work with them. And so instead of sending in some basic resume, I decided to go way out of my way to make this podcast for anybody out there, including any Intersection fans or any of my friends and family, so that people can finally see a more clear narrative. You know, my life and my entrepreneurial journey has been such a bounce back and forth that it may seem scattered and unfocused, but through this story, you'll see how I've been on to trying to do the same stuff, which even most of my closest friends and family have, frankly, no clue. I've given up a long time ago about trying to explain these threads, but now I think there's enough to show for where the congruency is in the way that I've been thinking and approaching my work for almost the past decade now, and how my unique insight into having a ridiculous amount of consumer empathy, understanding what's next in culture, but overall having a really strong sense for how to help companies and leaders within the tech scene build a stronger one-to-one relationship with their consumers and their audience, and all of my experience and knowledge at the intersection of technology and culture. Anybody who's a friend or a family member of mine or a fan of the intersection, you're gonna enjoy this. Ready? Let's get into it. Part 1, how my burning desire to find a unique entrepreneurial and creative community that I could not find no matter how hard or far I searched, I decided to create myself. This all started off in 2017 when I was 17 years old. Shout out to being born in 2000. It's really easy to keep track of my age that way. Hustle Gurus was a documentary style video series. I ran around Chicago with a camera strapped to my back and posting it on my YouTube to connect local entrepreneurs in Chicago. In the quest to find a community I was looking for, this audience of the video series would serve as a catalyst for this community to connect and crystallize. Even though it seemed semi-clear in my mind, I couldn't quite articulate why I couldn't find the community I was looking for in my gut. However, I could ingrain that feeling through every creative aspect of each piece of content and the brand at large, which is ultimately what creating a brand is all about, right? Expressing the core value of your brand through every touch point of someone's experience. If you pay attention to any of the videos of Hustle Gurus, you'll be able to see the interview questions I did, the video style, the graphics, the creators, and the people that I featured speaks to this brand ethos and mission. And in real time, video after video, which you can see on the Intersection YouTube channel and the Substack right here if you're reading it, these videos quickly improved over time. You know, as many founders do, when you have an insight, a gut feeling that is hard to articulate, you have to flesh it out through massive action. To my disappointment, I ended up experiencing burnout, not because of overworking. I knew at some point in my gutter intuition that I wasn't traveling in the direction that I was necessarily trying to get to. I felt like I was stuck in turning myself into a video creator, which again, wasn't my goal from the outset. I just wanted to use video to build a community. So in reorienting my direction through what felt very painful at the moment, I pivoted this video series exclusively into a podcast and rebranded the show The Do Good Collab and The Do Good Podcast. I've linked a few of my favorite of those episodes. You know, it's much easier to bring a guest and convince them to come on a podcast than it is to create an entire documentary-style video about their life, all the preparation that goes into that, get approvals of what I can and cannot film, edit these very lengthy, complicated videos, hours of footage, and so on and so forth. If I could just invite people to a podcast studio, maybe I could get in front of the right people much faster and build the right kind of audience for this interdisciplinary and collaborative community I was on the way to making happen. Fun fact, side note, I covertly gained access to a podcast recording space at Chicago's premier technology incubator and co-working space called 1871. As a rambunctious teenager, I befriended staff members and other members of the space who would let me in and give me access to resources with the unspoken but mutually understood thing that I was a broke high schooler who couldn't afford the membership. But through such a presentable space and a great recording studio, I ended up attracting all type of fantastic guests. I pulled this off for around 2 years until one of the not as resident staff members found out and asked me, you know, Matt, how do you get in here every day? And kicked me out, but it's okay, I still go back. Fast forward, again, I ran into the same issue of burnout and needing to reorient my focus. Is this really worth it if my goal is to not build a podcast, but to build a community? In the midst of this frustration, one day in the Albany Park Public Library, I sat down for maybe an hour to an hour and a half or 2 hours, banging my head. Matthew, what is this thing you're trying to create? How can you get there faster? And then I started writing, movie-esque type of scenario of a beautiful mind, or I felt like Einstein or some shit, because suddenly the idea was pouring out of me. Maybe the way to create the community I was looking for might serve much better as a co-working space, an incubator space. I had desperately searched all throughout Chicago, any physical collaborative space for entrepreneurs. And no matter where I went, whether it was 1871 for general technology, M-Hub for hardware manufacturing, Matter for health tech, 2112 for music business and music tech, Catapult for a curated cohort of entrepreneurs they intended to bet on for investment-related reasons, TechNexus, WeWork, Workbox, Pumping Station 1 for the super quirky material science, Fab Lab nerds. I love nerds, I'm a nerd myself, respect. Or even Lost Arts, founded by the then ex-co-founder of Kickstarter, Charles Adler. Or even all the university spaces, the Garage at Northwestern, the Polsky Center at the University of Chicago, Forge series from the University of Illinois. This is just to make the point that I really had this explorative and thirsty search, but they all felt limited and lackluster. I thought, why is this? I tried really hard to think about it. I thought, maybe, just maybe, in the interest of creating quote-unquote specialized communities for like-minded founders, all these communities had ended up stifling themselves and lacked a certain amount of cognitive diversity, and that sapped them out of a certain kind of creative inspiration. What if we could create a space where a hip-hop producer could work alongside an agriculture technology founder, or a streetwear fashion designer could work alongside a health technology founder, and that same streetwear fashion designer could go knock on the door of the material science engineers and ask them about using 3D printed dyes for their new fashion collection, or a fintech financial technology founder who's foreign to creative and media could go knock on the door of the videographer and photography studio and pitch them, hey guys, can you create an explainer video for my business in exchange for some stock points on my new trading platform? And so I vigorously wrote all of these kinds of examples down for cross-industry interdisciplinary talent. That was the key, and I thought I had hit a gold mine. And so I set out to build the Do Good Collab incubator and co-working space. However, I was still a broke 19-year-old living off McChickens, freelance video gigs, or my mom's cooking. What to do? I started pitching this vision everywhere I could, online, on every social media platform, and any person who was willing to listen. One day over time, I got direct word of through a mentor of mine, Liam Lee. There was a small health tech company on Grand Avenue near the Rainforest Cafe, the McDonald's, and the Portillo's. If you're from Chicago, you know what I'm talking about. And they were rapidly growing. They were about to outgrow this space, which could fit around 15 people. But they were still tied to the lease, and they wanted someone to pay the bills to pay it off. To make a long and maybe hard to follow story short, my friend Keisha Howard, founder of Sugar Gamers, presented an opportunity for me to save her dying co-working space, of which she was the last member, to work with the landlord and sell new tenants on operating out of the space. And while I was in the midst of frantically sending emails and texts and calling anyone I knew to try and sell them on this co-working space, because I only had 1 month to convince 9 different people to pay $1,000 a month to make it their new office, my mentor I mentioned, Liam Lee, responded to one of my emails about how she had a connection to this health tech company that might actually be a better place to operate my co-working space and that I would have more time to convince people and sell them on. The founder of this health tech company that was growing out of their space and needed someone to fill it was her friend and told her that as long as I could cover the rent and utilities and convince a group of entrepreneurs to pay, it was mine. It was a much more rinky-dinky space, but I only needed to close members at a $250 a month price. I had around 2.5 months of runway to make it happen. I set out frantically reaching out to anyone and everyone I knew, pitching this mission and vision. I've linked a video that I created in the physical space as a promotional tactic. To my surprise, I started getting interest. One person agreed, cool. Another person, awesome. A third person agreed to pay this $250. I'm like, holy shit, am I actually pulling this off? You know, I thought to myself. So I started doing tours, open houses. A week and a half left to pull this all through. I had ended up convincing 9 out of the 13 people I needed to cover rent and utilities. Unfortunately, my clumsy ass didn't account for the cost of amenities, internet, refurbishing the space. Those weren't all going to pay for themselves, you know, not to mention the costs of incorporating and other legalities, which I had never dealt with before. I reached out to my friend Spencer Gordon Sand, now founder of Spencer Ventures and partner at Lofty Ventures. He had an extensive network of top-tier investors on a global level, and I thought, if I can pitch this vision to enough people to want to come join the space, then surely there'd be an investor, you know? He said, hey Matt, send a video to us and we'll do what we can. Here's the video I submitted. It really articulates the essence of what I was trying to create. Again, if you're listening to this podcast, side note, it might be a lot more fun to listen to it alongside the written and visual experience on my Substack newsletter, which again, I've included in the description so you can see exactly what I'm talking about. Back to the story. Just a week or something or a few days before I was supposed to close the whole thing, a few of the soon-to-be members backed out in a humbling experience because they came out of the trance of my enchanting vision-pitching skills to the sobering reality of my obvious lack of formal business experience as a 19-year-old. Not to mention, only a few months later, COVID would begin to consume the world, and so the promise of running a co-working space would have collapsed anyway. It wasn't until last year that I decided to revamp this vision as a new podcast format with a fresh brand called The Intersection. I developed a much more mature, clearly articulated expression of this vision because at the intersection of tech, culture, business, and the arts, would form all of the unconventional mix of people I felt like was lacking. Because also, the intersection could mean anything. If it ends up evolving, the intersection could mean the intersection of any kind of industry. It's a proper way now to define the community. I was hoping to start an event series soon, but I ended up putting the show in the intersection on pause. It wasn't generating me any money, and I was at a point in my life where life be lifing. The cool thing about the intersection, though, was in spite of having this average of less than 100 views, through my ability to tell great stories and to pitch, I was able to bring on fantastic guests such as Nate Jones, former director of the Talent Opportunity Initiative at Andreessen Horowitz, and who was an 8-year partner there, who told crazy stories like hanging out in Mark Zuckerberg's backyard with Kanye and Ben Horowitz, drinking and listening to rock music at 3 in the morning. Andy Dunn, founder of Bonobos, who sold to Walmart for $300 million. Jason Ma, the co-founder of 88 Rising. Emma McKee, whose Stitch embroideries have been picked up by the likes of Bad Bunny, Kanye, Kendrick Lamar, and Chance the Rapper. Not to mention, again, the mutual connection between me and VaynerX, my boy, Solo Cello. All right, that's the end of part one, the overarching intersection storyline of how I always wanted to build an entrepreneurial community, but I couldn't quite figure out what the unique insight was in my gut. And so it evolved and rebranded and was reattempted, where now today, the light at the end of the tunnel is very clear. I know exactly what kind of community I'm building. Part two, my time at Lightpong, building the world's first one-dimensional game console. Let's take a step back to 2021. I was recruited to join a budding ragtag team getting ready to launch a new video game hardware product on Kickstarter called Lightpong. We were creating the world's quote-unquote first one-dimensional game console that could play a bunch of very simple intuitive games through this tube of LED lights. Quote-unquote, whether you were 6 or 66, you could play Lightpong and share it with your family and friends. There I went. Pew! My job became to do pre-launch marketing for this Kickstarter campaign, trying to make videos of the product go viral so that we could increase our pre-orders. I ended up, to my surprise even, generating 50 million views in less than 2.5 months across TikTok, YouTube Shorts, Instagram Reels, and I forget what it was called, but Snapchat had its own vertical video platform. I ended up running all of our social media profiles, TikTok, Discord, YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, uploading content on a daily basis, creating content strategy schedules. And then when the Kickstarter launched, my focus shifted to being the one-on-one touch point with our audience and community. One of my unique approaches was to intimately involve our Kickstarter backers and all of our pre-order customers into feeling like they were a part of our team, to know that your opinion, your creativity as a consumer, as an audience member, can actually make a difference into the product development process itself. Stuff I did to let people in to contribute to the product development process included remote interviews and having people around the world be a part of our content behind the scenes as things developed, live sessions on our Discord, whether it was our graphic designer, the CTO, sound effects lead, our UX designer, etc. I would make sure that they got set up on a live stream of their work. Our community would be notified so that they could hop in and give their own feedback and opinions in real time. Here in the Substack is a little example of these different kinds of things. I led community engagement sessions in the form of live streams, game nights. They could watch our team play light pong together, watch us work in the late night, or even silly experimental stuff like we said, hey guys, tune in this week to watch the team drink Pilk, which is a combination of Pepsi and milk, and there was some kind of trend around it or something. It was ridiculous. Any and every single piece of media, whether it's all the videos across all our social media channels or even professional photography, was due to my production. Professional Chicago photographers would tag along with me and we would go on ragtag missions to bars and nightclubs, which sometimes would work out to our great benefit. The venue owners would say, what the hell is this? What did you guys bring in here? Is this a part of the venue? And we'd say no. And they'd say, oh, well, interesting. You get my info. On the flip side, people would get really mad and say, you're stealing business, do-do-do-do-do, and kick us out. It was a fun time, though. On top of that, similarly to the essence of the day-in-the-life documentary-style videos behind Hustle Gurus, every other week created a new update video on a very transparent, behind-the-scenes look into what it was like day-to-day building Lightpong. And it became this very human, transparent look, being able to see what it was like for us to build the thing in real time. I also decided as a direct messaging strategy, whether it was Instagram or any other social platform, to manually myself send messages between thousands of different online audience members that may seem like unnecessary manual effort. But I thought there was something really interesting and genuine and human. People would say after I messaged them, oh, fuck you, you stupid company trying to get me to buy stuff. And I'd say, no, this is a real person. They'd say, huh, prove it. And I would prove it. And people would be baffled. They would be shocked. Totally 180, change their language and suddenly start talking to me about how their day was going, what they're up to. And not only open up about themselves on a very human level, which I think did something profound to our brand awareness, by the time that we actually had an ask, shout out to Gary V. I didn't even think of it this way at the time, but now I am. Jab, jab, right hook. That is, if you're not familiar to the jab, jab, right hook concept, it's about giving value, and then asking things from your audience or your customers. I was having these human-to-human conversations, and when we needed people to vote for us for awards or be involved in giving feedback on certain things, I could ask that of them, and it wasn't a random out of the blue request. They knew it was Matt. So I was able to pull in all type of different requests, which helped us in a plethora of ways. I was the unique touch point between our customers, our audience, our playtesters, and the company. Unfortunately, the product has still not launched yet. We're not going to get into all that. That's another recording for itself. Part 3, my most recent employment, and maybe my last, or not, depending on if VaynerX has anything to say about it. My time at the MIT co-founded music and AI startup, Rivet. So after leaving Lightpong, I ended up joining Rivet, a music technology and AI startup to essentially help music artists make it easier to make a living from their art and connect with their fans. Looking for a digital marketing lead, and this position was brought into my awareness by my good friend Landon Campbell, the Chicago general manager of Drive Capital. Landon himself is very focused on shifting Chicago's traditional behavior of being very risk averse and investing in boring companies to start investing at what he likes to call napkin stage level ideas. Before even my first introductory meeting with them, I probably spent over 10 hours creating a super extensive spreadsheet of all the music artists, artist managers, DJs, event curators, and any other music-related talent I had a personal relationship with in Chicago, which happens to be quite a damn few bit of people, just to prove and show to them how much I was willing to open my arms to my own network and how much of a network I really do have of the creative music scene in Chicago, which we'll get into a second because I was trying to be a rapper for a long time. I've included this list in the Substack. I walked into the office during our very first initial meeting and I said, hey, you know, at first I was just going to come into the office to help you guys for the sake of it. Then I was going to try and pitch you on my own consultancy. Now I'm applying for the digital marketing role. And the co-founder head of product Simran said, take a walk with me. And before you knew it, to my delight, I was eventually brought onto the Rivet team as one of the first people to ever join the company. At Rivet, so what did I do? I proceeded to lead most of all of our artist development, product feedback, user research work to get people's feedback behind their psychology and lifestyle in relation to the ever-evolving product of Rivet, alongside Rivet's co-founder, head of product Simran, and attempt to onboard them in the process. All the artists and creatives invited to the office, I personally invited, coordinated, and facilitated 40 to 50 people within the 4 to 5 month span I was there, and I was very confident that via my support, we could elevate our brand awareness for us on a local, intimate level. Another key aspect of my role was how I became direct partners with the fractional CMO, Brian Dima. Brian is the former director of marketing strategy at Silicon Valley Bank, the director of middle market corporate banking at JPMorgan Chase for 2 years. Brian and I co-led all types of PR work, message testing to try and get really peculiar and specific on how to articulate the value proposition of Rivet. Every single music publication from Chicago or every single message testing participant, take a guess. How did these all get locked in? Through me. Brian, being a senior veteran marketing professional, was able to add his corporate experience to what was my ragtag, scrappy personal network of what happened to be the perfect kind of target audience. To the very end, by the time Brian and I departed from Rivet, he really advocated for me and believed in me in ways more than I believed in myself, which was, you know, really endearing. On top of all this, I was deemed the CEO of the Fanarchy with Rivet podcast, an experimental podcast we started to not just exist as a random fun podcast for the company, but to be a direct value extension of the product where, since artists are coming to Rivet to make it easier for them to make a living from their art, we wanted to create a podcast about artists, artist managers, and other people in the music industry giving game on how to help artists manage the business side of their work. My personal take on a company's content strategy is that if it isn't helping you build a more intimate one-to-one connection with your audience or making it easier to understand and navigate your company's offerings, then it needs to be about achieving the same kinds of things to provide the same kind of core value that your product or service is already doing. To help you build more credibility as a company that makes that kind of thing happen for people. We had a ton of really cool guests on the show, including Chicago legends like King Louie, Joey Perp. When I met King Louie for the first time, I walked up to him to dap him up and said, "Live and die in Chicago." He's like, "Word." Or other super dope music industry professionals who are able to give artists game, like Chris Classic, one of the most legendary studio owners in Chicago, not to mention Doja Cat's manager and co-founder of music tech corporation Songfinch, Josh Kaplan. All on my own, I fully edited, wrote all of the questions for, filmed, sourced several guests for, and led all of our growth strategy and marketing strategies, and created all of the social media content, hundreds of different clips, and ran our podcast hosting platform on Buzzsprout, so on and so forth, fully running the podcast all on my own, and then letting the CEO, Anj, step in during the interviews to ask the questions that I had created and engage with our guests. I've linked some of my favorite episodes of Fanarchy with Rivet, linked in the Substack. And then just like I did at Light Pong, I made sure to include our audience and our community into the content marketing strategy in a very human, non-scripted way. With my friends like Drew the Kid, who opened up for Lil Durk at the United Center, or Sam Thousand, a veteran live musician, performer, to explain certain aspects of Rivet that make it what it is, through the language and the lens of their own experience. The team then included these videos on the website as official how-to videos. Or this funny example of an artist who made the most out of the platform, so I made sure to reach out to him on my behalf and make a little fun, "Here's how to make the most of Rivet," featuring doo-doo-doo-doo artist, making the rest of the audience feel open and connected to other users of the platform, but also making that artist feel like the fact they made the most out of the platform is encouraged, respected, and uplifted. Eventually, I decided, for various reasons, I kind of just really want to do my own thing, and so I left on good terms with the founding team. My priority focus became building one-to-one insight, my consumer empathy and understanding consultancy to help founding teams and corporate executive teams understand their current customers and their target audience better than they think they already did, almost like a business or technology anthropologist. Part 4, my full circle trip back to being a solo founder at One-to-One Insight. Steve Blank, the godfather of customer discovery, have said famously that you can't outsource this kind of work, the act of talking to users. It always has to be the founding team doing this. So I set up One-to-One not to be some kind of third-party outsourced assistant, rather a coach to equip founders and founding teams with new skills, methodologies for the act of talking to users and learning from their users with more grace and effectiveness. Ironically, this skill took me no degree. You know, I went to the School of Hard Knocks. This is super relevant, I know, to VaynerX, because you guys are all about an obsessive focus on the consumer and having empathy for the consumer and seeing consumer behavior and where that's headed and what that means for industries and culture at large before anyone else does. And da-dunch, this is my specialty. This is my bread and butter. For example, one project that was super cool was helping one of my best friends, Gabe Tavas, founder of Symmetry Wood, who happened to be my first ever business partner. Gabe and his team are material science experts, and they've created this material that mimics exotic wood in the interest of combating deforestation and protecting indigenous people's communities. If you can create a material that mimics trees like ebony, which serve as a very dark, exotic, high-paying wood, and illegal logging companies end up cutting down tons of other trees just to get at these specific high-paying woods, it has so many terrible ecological implications and implications on indigenous peoples throughout the world. Symmetry Wood has been featured in the World Economic Forum and winner of the James Dyson Award International Design Competition. Symmetry Wood was confronted with a mission to figure out what kind of initial consumer product to invest their material into creating for with a limited amount of resources and funding. They thought creating materials and products for guitars was a great idea, but they weren't quite 100% confident about it. Gabe, on his own, had tried to do this kind of customer discovery research by talking to different guitar store owners and enthusiasts about their experience and understanding of the wood material itself. But he was struggling a bit with it, and knowing I had just started One-to-One brought me on to help. With only so much funding and resources to produce this material, Pyrus, it's putting a lot on the line for your budding startup. If they created Pyrus on the assumption that the guitar market would be receptive to it and it's not, that's going to be a problem. So here I came in. With zero experience in this industry, I jumped in, as I decided, let's not talk to guitar enthusiasts, rather large guitar manufacturing executives, to understand what they think about sustainability. Have they tried alternative materials? The same for their consumers. What do they know about their consumer sentiment around this kind of stuff? How have they tried to service it? Somehow, miraculously, as I always do with my cold outreach methods, I got on calls with large guitar manufacturing executives, including the VP of sales and customer engagement at Fender, or exotic wood buyers at Martin, and creating a super detailed insight report on, is this an appropriate place to focus their first efforts so that they don't waste the production of their materials? You can actually see the case study on onetoinsight.com. All right, here we go to wrap this all up. Part 5, how Matt got his foothold in the creative arts through trying to make it as a rapper in high school. And in much, much relevance to potentially being heavily involved in the music industry as a creative strategist via VaynerX, I was utterly convinced into trying to make it as a hip-hop artist. Let's go back to around early 2015. Shout out to Solo Cello and the rest of ETP, Exit the Premises, my guys, the gang, would start to create a bunch of music videos on YouTube. One day, as a half-serious slash half-joking request, you know, hey, let me be in one of the videos. And I still remember what would end up being my first verse in what is a now long time ago deleted video. Let me try to run it back for you in my 15-year-old voice. Yeah, rap so swift, my game knocked out. Chief with the fire, call it a cookout. Your bars so dry, you could call it a drought. And I'm having some doubt that you down for the count. If you having some doubt, I like you to announce. Stuff so good, counted up by the ounce. Blah, 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 I ask you to pronounce. Some of y'all try to keep it low-key. Switch up emotions with emojis. I would call that straight baloney. Super duper squad, day one homies. I brought this to my high school. And I played it in my Japanese class, and even shout out to Park Sensei was watching. People suddenly were like, wow, Matt, this is so amazing. Whoa, Matt, bro, keep doing this, bro. Keep at it. This shit is good. I made singles, 2 EPs, mixtapes, designing graphic art, distributing my music on streaming platforms, learning Apple's Logic to record songs, performing in front of Chance the Rapper, his Social Works open mics for high schoolers, clothing store basements, hole-in-the-wall venues. I would navigate my way to find studio spaces in Chicago, learn how to work with engineers, you know, the whole nine yards. Even when the music wasn't good, ignoring the haters at school, as I really tried to make it as a music artist, ETP was really like, you know, these are my guys, shout out to the gang. I made a lot of friendships that would lead to, in a compound effect, more and more creative relationships between videographers, choreographers, DJs, radio hosts, event curators, fashion designers, engineers, producers, which ended up evolving to present day as a very unique advantage that was the cause and effect of being able to do things like tap into all of the artist relationships that was the crux of all of that work I did at Rivet. For the final cherry on top, here is a TEDx talk I did for the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Art of Networking, Blending the Personal and Professional. Shout out to my guy Jason Dombelli, who gave me the call one day to ask me if I wanted to do it. So random. There you have it. I don't know if Mike Boyd listened to all of this. If you did happen to listen to this, bro, wow, that's crazy. And then obviously, shout out to anybody who's a fan of The Intersection or any of my homies listening. Shout out to you guys. And I hope you enjoyed this. Hope you enjoyed my story. Peace.